Makamura Shava said mutual ties with Yuan is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round, and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn what they call the illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir regions by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events, including conferences and seminars, attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities as Lahore, Karachi and Islamabad. Kashmir Solidarity Day is marked in Pakistan every year on February 5. The day marks the nation's renewed commitment to the people of Indian-administered Kashmir. Participants in the rallies demanded the UN Security Council to implement its resolutions on Kashmiris' right to self-determination and end what they called the bloodshed in the Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir.
Observance of Solidarity Day on February 5 is proof of Pakistan's continued support for Kashmiris. We will never accept India's occupation of Jammu and Kashmir and will continue our struggle for the independence of the Kashmiri people.
The purpose of celebrating the day is to renew the pledge that the people of Pakistan will continue to provide moral, political, and diplomatic support to their Kashmiri brothers and sisters until the independence of Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region, is divided into Indian and Pakistani sections, but claimed by both in full. The Kashmir dispute has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed rivals since Pakistan's independence in 1947.
The United Nations should play its role in ending the decades-long sufferings of Kashmiris who are struggling for their right to self-determination. The world should urge India to hold composite and meaningful dialogues with all the stakeholders to resolve the dispute.
Relations between India and Pakistan worsened in 2019 when the Indian government revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted Indian-administered Kashmir partial autonomy.
Islamabad has long argued that Kashmir should have acceded to Pakistan because of its Muslim majority population. However, the court response from India in this regard has put the matter on hold. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean families of the victims of the crowd crush that killed 159 mostly young people last Halloween gathered at the memorial in Itaewon on Saturday to mark 100 days since the tragedy. They demand a thorough independent probe and accountability.
We definitely need to know the reason why our children died here last October 29th. I think the only thing we can do for our sons and daughters who left this world for no reason is to hold those responsible and punish them.
Demonstrators marched from the memorial past the presidential office. 11 emergency calls were made in the hours before the disaster. Local officials knew tens of thousands would gather in Itaewon, but crowd control was not implemented. Still, the safety minister said the deaths could not have been prevented, angering family members. One investigation has led to a handful of indictments of police on duty and low-level officials, but top officials have been spared.
Naturally, it is the President, the Minister of the Interior and Safety, and the Commissioner of the National Police Agency who are obliged to take responsibility for the lives and safety of citizens. But from the beginning, right after the disaster, they sought to avoid responsibility, and politicians continue to insult the families and victims.
City Hall denied the marchers access to the nearby plaza for their demonstration, as the fallout from the tragedy turns ever more political. 26 foreigners died in the crowd crush last Halloween. Five of those were young Iranian exchange students. And as the families and their supporters seek justice, they face harassment and official indifference. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July, when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Boluarte thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls, accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
Mi renuncia no está en...
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected the export of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shatter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The withdrawal of the country from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic caused the economy to be about 20% smaller than in 2020. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, rejected calls to prevent sharp rises in domestic energy bills for all households in his March budget, meaning millions of Britons will see costs soar by about 40% from April. Instead, Jeremy Hunt will claim the extra support he's giving to the poorest and most vulnerable households, including those on benefits, in what he will describe as a more fairly targeted system of support. Demands for the Treasury to halt a planned rise in the energy price guarantee, the discounted cost of gas and electricity to consumers from £2,500 to £3,000 a year for the average household in the March budget have been growing in recent weeks, particularly as the whole wholesale cost of energy has been falling. Because an additional £400 of extra government help with energy costs for all households made in monthly payments since October also ends in March, the effective rise for all but those under lowest incomes will be about 40%. Calls for the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, to stop the rise in the energy price guarantee have been led by consumer champion Martin Lewis, founder of the website MoneySavingExpert.com, who has said the move would be an obvious rabbit out of the hat that the Chancellor could afford to pull out of his red box in March. The Labour Party, meanwhile, has also been calling for the rise in the energy price guarantee to be stopped and for the extra cost to the government of doing so to be met through the proceeds of a more punitive windfall tax on the vast profits of energy companies. But Treasury insiders have told The Observer that the move is not under consideration, partly because Treasury receipts from its own windfall tax on energy companies have been less than expected, and because of worries about exposing taxpayers to future market rise. Ruling out the move, a Treasury source said, while gas prices have fallen in recent months, they are still five times higher than the historical average and can just as easily increase. The source added, if the gas price spikes, the government will need to borrow billions of pounds more, while the energy price guarantee will continue to insulate millions of households from even higher wholesale gas prices. We need to reduce the taxpayer exposure to market volatility. Insulating every household and on an open-ended basis could have major implications for the public finances. Officials said that at the time of the autumn statement last November, the Treasury's own estimate for the proceeds of the windfall tax over 5 years was £55 billion. But because of recent falls in energy prices, this total has fallen by £25 billion and was now anticipated to come in closer to £30 billion. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves said the prospect of such steep rises for most households was frightening and shameful at a time when energy giants were reaping huge profits. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, households in England and Wales will see the largest increase to their water bills in almost 20 years from this April, when they rise to an average of £448 a year. Industry body Water UK said the 7.5% increase would see customers pay around £1.23 per day on average, an increase of 8 pence per day, or an average of £31 more on last year's charges. Consumer groups warned the rise could prove the tipping point for one in five customers already struggling to pay. But Water UK claimed the water bills remained lower in real terms than they were a decade ago and said this year's increase reflected higher energy costs, with water firms using around 2% of the nation's electricity. It announced firms were set to invest a further £70 billion to eliminate harm from storm overflows and increase water supplies by building new reservoirs and national water transfer schemes, claiming that they were acutely aware of the impact of price rises on lower income and vulnerable customers and had recently increased the level of support they offered by more than £200 million. Water UK Director of Policy Stuart Colville said, "With an average increase of around 60 pence a week, most customers will again see a below-inflation increase in their water bill. However, we know that any increase is unwelcome, particularly at the moment." The Consumer Council for Water announced regional variations and factors such as whether a customer is metered and how much water they use meant some households could face rises significantly above or below the average. The Consumer Council for Water Chief Executive Emma Clancy said, "Water is essential for all of us, so no one should be worried about being able to afford their bill. These increases will bring more uncertainty to struggling households at a time when they can't be certain that they will get the help that they need." Emma Clancy added, "Low-income households need immediate relief and the long-term security of knowing their water bill will be affordable. It is not fair that struggling households face a postcode lottery when it comes to getting help with their water bill. That's why we urgently need a new water affordability scheme that provides consistent support based on people's needs." The website MSN.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The impending recession could leave borrowers struggling to repay their debts, the high street bank Santander UK said as it put aside more cash to protect itself from potential defaults. The UK arm of the Spanish bank said recently that while the outlook for Britain's economy remained uncertain, a recession in 2023 was likely. It said that despite government support for energy bills, rising prices would continue to eat away at disposable income, which could impact lending repayments. The warning was issued alongside the bank's full-year results, which showed the lender put aside £321 million in 2022 to cover potential defaults, compared with the £233 million it released a year earlier as COVID restrictions began to lift. The higher figure was because of the deterioration in the economic environment, including higher interest rates, lower economic growth, and a drop in house prices, which Santander predicts will fall by about 10% to levels not seen since 2021. The bank said, "These challenges for households and businesses are expected to continue into 2023 and could impact credit quality," referring to the ability of borrowers to repay their loans and mortgages. On Wednesday, Virgin Money set aside £66 million to cover a possible rise in bad debts in the first quarter of this year. However, the Challenger Bank said repayments had been stable so far. Santander's provision for potential defaults weighed on the lender's profits, which rose just 2% to nearly £1.9 billion over the year to December. The flat growth was despite a 12% increase in net interest income to £4.5 billion, as the interest rate rise allowed it to charge more for mortgages and loans. Profits were also subdued by the £421 million it put aside to cover the cost of fraud and scams, as well as a £108 million regulatory fine from the Financial Conduct Authority. In December, the UK regulator issued the bank with a penalty over serious and persistent gaps in its anti-money laundering controls between 2012 and 2017. Santander UK said it was also affected by a marked slowdown in mortgage lending at the end of the year as interest rates increased to 3.5%.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution statement addressed to the Iranian nation on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In the name of God, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Muhammad al-Mustafa, upon his pure and immaculate household, upon his chosen companions, and upon those who follow them in charity until the Day of Judgment. Among all the nations suffering from oppression, few make an effort to launch a revolution. And among those nations that have risen and launched a revolution, few have been witnessed to have pursued it to the end, or moved beyond merely changing the government and safeguarded the revolutionary values. However, the auspicious revolution of the Iranian nation, which is the greatest and most popular revolution of the contemporary era, is the sole revolution that has persisted 40 years of pride, safe from betrayal to its values, and it has preserved its dignity and original slogans against all the temptations which seemed irresistible. Hence, entering the second phase of the self-development, society processing, and civilization building.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Heartfelt salutations to this nation, the generation who initiated and continued the movement, and the generation that currently steps into the magnificent and global phenomenon of the second 40 years. The day when the world was divided into material West and East, and no one presumed a major religious movement would emerge, the Islamic Revolution of Iran stepped into the scene gloriously and mightily. It broke the frameworks. It flaunted to the world the outdatedness of its clichés. It put the religion and the material world together and declared the coming of a new era. It was much expected that the leaders of deviation and oppression would react, but in vain. Whatever the right and left modernity did, from pretending to ignore this emerging and unprecedented voice to extensive efforts for suffocating it, just brought them closer to their indispensable demise. Today, after 40 annual celebrations of the victory of the revolution and more than 40 fetch 10 days, one of the two centers of animosity has already perished, and the second one is struggling with its predicaments that signal its death in the near future. Whereas the Islamic Revolution is advancing while preserving and adhering to its mottos.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered a State of the Union address to Congress, saying that the U.S. seeks competition with China rather than conflict. Biden also stated that the U.S. will cooperate with China for interests, and countermeasures will be taken if national sovereignty is threatened, such as the Chinese balloon that accidentally slipped into U.S. airspace. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at this relationship, which China wants non-interference, while the U.S. seems to be on a war path. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who also joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you and see what you think about this particular statement coming at the State of the Union address of Biden, where he said, "I'm committed to work with China where we can advance American interests and benefit the world, but make no mistake, as we made it clear last week, if China threatens our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country." And we did, in reference to that balloon. What do you think of that?
Well, the words are diplomatic. The words have been very carefully chosen. However, how much depends on Mr. Biden individually in the formulation and in the deployment of U.S. foreign policy is something of a puzzle. He has, going back to November and his meeting with Xi, he has come out as in a statement-like way, calling for cooperation and for a well-contained relationship with China. However, after each of these events, after each time that Biden comes out looking reasonable, there are actions by his administration which put in jeopardy all of the reasonableness that were in his words. I very much anticipate the same will be true now. What Mr. Biden says to Congress in the State of the Union message has to be seen as conciliatory for the sake of the American public. The reality is something that we'll see in the coming days and weeks.
Well, Elijah Magner, when Biden says, if China friends our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country, and then he says, and we did, well, China, can it not say the same thing when it comes to the U.S.? I mean, if the U.S. approaches that way, then China should obviously, as an equal, do the same, right?
Potentially, yes. However, China is offering a complete different model from the U.S. The U.S. is a warmongering state that since Second World War is waging wars against several countries because that enrich the United States economy. However, China has not been engaged in the arms race between the Americans and the Soviet Union before the perestroika and was building its economy. Therefore, regardless the numerous provocation that the Americans are trying to push China into, particularly in Taiwan, but not only limited to Taiwan, by pushing Japan to increase its budget for defense by Britain going to Japan and signing a defense deal by the Americans selling $1.5 billion worth of weapon to Taiwan, by seeing all the Americans official visiting Taiwan, and at the same time, the level of hypocrisy of the United States administration when saying we recognize China and Taiwan are one country and Taiwan is part of China. However, they behave like Taiwan is a completely independent, it's a military base, and it's a place that is under the U.S. control. China has been waiting for the last 100 years without being provoked by the Americans, and will wait further. It doesn't mean that China is weak. On the contrary, China is watching very carefully what's happening in Ukraine, is learning a lot the style of NATO in fighting, what kind of warfare the West can wage against another country like China, because the main objective is not Russia, is to push away Russia and for the United States to dedicate all its effort toward China. And all that, the Chinese are very much aware of that and watching carefully, building their capability, military and economy, trying to be independent, creating their own semiconductor because they wanted to be independent from Taiwan, and preparing for the worst without offering a model that their option is always the war. On the contrary, they build the wall to keep away from the rest of the world and not to go and attack. They are building a prosperous economical alliance with many continents because they're saying, you become rich and we become rich with you. And they're not saying, we occupy you and we destroy you like the Americans did.
Well, that's the whole thing here. The approaches, right, Gilbert Doctorow? I mean, I guess they're going to say it better. But the Chinese side, for example, coming from its foreign ministry spokesman, always believe that China-U.S. relations are not a zero-sum game in which you lose and I win and you rise and I fall. That's how China has categorized this relationship. But, of course, the U.S. has its own version, like what the president said when it comes to competition. The U.S. seeks competition with China rather than conflict. That's kind of hard to believe when you take a look at Taiwan, isn't it? When it's pumping military supplies there, when it fuels separatist aspirations and sends high-ranking U.S. officials to that island.
Well, I would like to add remarks that fill out a bit what my fellow panelists have said. China is not a country of bunny rabbits. Unlike Russia, which has been, for the most part, under the last 20 years of Mr. Putin, reactive to Western pressures and Western aggressive actions, in terms of expansion of NATO. China has been proactive and has been an initiator of efforts to further its own domestic security at the expense of the United States. By pushing out into the South China Sea, by constructing these artificial islands that have a defense purpose, China is clearly intent on removing American presence in its immediate neighborhood. That is not an aggressive position, but it is a clearly defined defensive position that comes at the expense of the United States. And in light of that, American behavior has to be interpreted as in part responding to the Chinese efforts. In this way, when I speak of it in this way, we have a situation that is very different from NATO expansion up to the borders of Russia. Here it is Chinese expansion in terms of its building its navy to the largest in the world, and it's building support for the navy in these artificial islands. They are proactively extending their military strength in their neighborhood.
Do you agree with our guest there, Elijah Magner, because in a sense it's a reaction to some of your statements that you made prior?
Well, it's very nicely put. However, China is not building military bases around the United States. The United States has increased the building of more military bases in the Philippines, adding four more, and then it has a dozen more of bases in different countries. This is not what China is doing. China made a deal with the Solomon Island that is 9,000 miles away from the United States, and the United States considered that as an attack against its sovereignty, and it's a threat to the national security. We're talking about 9,000 miles a deal between the Solomon Island and China. When we see in Ukraine with the Russian, and we're not justifying the Russian occupation here, it's saying that Ukraine represents a security, national security danger. So by China building its navy and its military, well done, because it is threatened by the United States that is going to the China Sea. The NATO is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization that's supposed not to be to put its nose in the China Sea, is going to talk to Korea, is talking to Japan, and is trying to collaborate with them. NATO is a military apparatus made for 30 nations under the U.S. Control and command. What NATO is doing in China, around China?
Gilbert Doctorow.
Well, so far, this is jawboning. It is, you have in mind clearly Mr. Stoltenberg's visit to Korea. The United States is trying to find support in the neighboring countries of China for its containment policy. Its success in this regard has been mixed. And to liken this to NATO, that is something that Washington would welcome as a concept, but it is not the case in fact. The Southeast Asian countries, led by Indonesia, have been resistant to America's calls to actively engage in containment against China. The case of Philippines is a special one. It has its own special history and contested issues with China. And Philippines has gone this way and that way over the last 20 years with respect to its closeness or remoteness from the United States and United States policies. As to Japan and Korea, this is not a shut case. The United States has a lot of work to do if it is to formulate an alliance that has any effect in containing China. The NATO is completely subservient to the United States. Europe is subservient to the United States in a way that the Asian countries so far have resisted.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, since we're talking about NATO, what is the deal with an Asian NATO? If you can tell us, Elijah Magnier, because it was in June that NATO actually had a summit, and for the first time it included the countries, which I'm reading here, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. And of course, then it fueled speculation that there's going to be a NATO, Asian NATO. Why does a NATO feel it has to expand all over the world and unite countries? And in this case, obviously, it would be against China.
Well, the rule is very simple. The United States doesn't prefer to go to war alone. The American administration needs always allies to be with it, to go to war with it. This is what the Americans have done in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria. NATO is there, is everywhere. Why? Because the United States is saying, well, we're not alone. However, the West represents only between 14 to 16% of the world population. Nonetheless, they are made of warmongering states who follow the U.S. policy blindly and who walk along with what the U.S. objectives are. So when NATO is moving around, NATO is not an independent organization. NATO is made of 30 nations led by the U.S. The commander is an American, and the biggest budget is offered by the Americans. So when the NATO is moving, it means that the Americans is telling those who are concerned that we are not alone against you, but we will have a coalition of different nations.
Okay. If you have a reaction to our guest there, Elijah Magnier, Gilbert Doctorow, go ahead. If not, I'm going to move to another issue when it comes to China and the U.S. Do you have a reaction to Elijah Magnier?
No, I have no difficulty with what he's just
said. Okay, so let's move to one of the things that stands out when it comes to this relationship. And this, I believe, was really something that was put out there strongly, and I'm going to come from the U.S. side, from Anthony Blinken. This is going back a few months, calling China the most serious long-term threat to the world order. Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. And I'm just going to stop there, where you have the U.S. obviously having that particular view, but yet China doesn't feel that way. What is the deal with the way that the U.S. thinks about China in those in that scene or in that context?
I would change the language a little bit to other terms that Blinken and State Department people have been using from time to time. And that word is revisionist. Both Russia and China have been categorized by the State Department, by the United States administration, as being revisionist states. What exactly does that mean? I think that is a more accurate description of the global situation than what you just were mentioning 2 minutes ago, that these countries do not respect the values and are challenging the principles that underlie world order. It is more precise. It is to speak about the alignment of the world's nations at the board of directors table. And that is where the revisionism comes in. It is truly accurate that these two countries, in particular China and Russia, are leading the pack. India is also a very active participant in the call for revising the seating order at the table of governors of the world. in China and Russia are the leaders, but there are a number of other countries that are followers, and all of this is seen to be aimed at undermining and overturning the United States' global hegemony.
And to just finish this particular topic off, Elijah Magnier, you have a U.S. senator that says we have different visions for whether the world should be safer for democracy or authoritarianism. When you have a U.S. senator say that, where this particular senator said the world of Chinese President Xi Jinping's vision would be unacceptable, why does the U.S. think that their way is the way that has to move forward and not any others, especially China's?
The problem is the Chinese, the Russian, the North Korean never claimed to be democratic countries. However, we in the West claim to have democracy. Nonetheless, we have a letter received by a U.S. Secretary of State, Tillerson, Rex Tillerson, telling him that we use human rights only against our enemy, but not against our friend who are dictator. Therefore, we have a double standard when they are clearly saying, this is our regime, this is how we rule, this is how we control our country, and you deal with us. This is what, like the Americans are dealing with countries like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt, like Jordan, like so many other countries considered friend of the U.S. And here I don't use the world order or the international order, because there isn't a world order. There is a Western order. There is a Western a value and Western understanding of how things to be done. And the reason why China is a serious threat, look what's happening today. China has its own strong currency. It has reserves in gold, huge reserve in gold, when the U.S. is indebted to $31.4 trillion. It has an Asian bank with $100 billion capital. It is building the Silk Road, connecting Asia, Europe, and Africa. All these plans represent a serious danger to, as Yoget said, the U.S. hegemony.
Well, an interesting piece of stat came out, and it's not very recent, but it came out just recently, Gilbert Doctorow, which points to whether the U.S. is actually ready to go down the route that it is. I mean, I'm not too sure what goes on in terms of, obviously, the way that they've mapped out their approach to China. But when you look at goods that were traded between the U.S. and China for 2022, it's hit a record high. What are we looking at? The $690.5 billion for the year 2022. How can the U.S. even think, then, from decoupling from China in one way or another, when it's and asking other countries to do so, when it's having record trade happen between it and China?
Well, you're pointing to the logical disconnect in the policies of the American foreign establishment. The President Putin is in remarking on America's simultaneously trying to contain Russia and China, and thereby pushing them into one another's arms. The United States is pursuing what Putin called an insane policy. And I think that, regrettably, that characterization holds true. The United States cannot possibly decouple from China and still have store shelves filled with products for the American consumers to buy. This is a long-term process, but the United States is concentrating on several very sensitive areas, and beginning with semiconductors, to contain China's growth and prevent its further expansion as a global power at the expense of America's position. So the decoupling is being handled with great care, since, as I said, if it were to be done to the full extent, the United States stores would all be bare of products. But this is directional, what is going on, and the intention is that over time, the Chinese role in global trade will be diminished. Will they succeed? It is anyone's guess. China, for its own part, is now directing a great deal of effort to develop the consumer side of its own economy and to become less reliant on export earnings.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to expand more on that chip issue because that is a huge one, but because of lack of time, the question now to you, Elijah Magnier, is about the U.S. warning to China, where he shot off one when it came to Russia, confronting China over companies that have ties to Russia, because according to the way the U.S. sees it, there's evidence of non-lethal aid, as it has called it, going to Russia. At the same time, we're looking at Russia-China ties to be solid as ever. Where do you see that going? Because we know how the U.S. can react when it comes to Russia and China in any form assisting it.
Russia is a country that can declare war. We've seen Russia in Ukraine, before that in Georgia, in Moldova, in different places where the Russians have the courage or the intention to go and declare war on other states. However, China has not been doing so since decades. And because the Chinese did not declare war against countries that fall within the U.S. satellite, the problem with China, between China and the U.S., is it is important for the U.S. to separate China from Russia. The more threat China feels from the U.S., the closer Chinese are going to go toward Russia because they're learning from this war. They are seeing what the Americans and NATO are using, what kind of weapons and tactics are using in this war, what kind of sanctions they are imposing on Russia, how far they can go, how they can damage infrastructure, how they can really damage themselves in order to damage Russia, like cutting the gas at Mainstream 1 and 2. So all that is a very rich learning ground for the Chinese. And the way China is standing next to Russia is, as long as Russia is at war with the U.S., the U.S. will be busy away from China, which is a very clever way to do it. However, the Chinese